What's up, sports fans? Welcome to another episode of Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm King Kaz, and I'm joined by my friend, the one, the great, JVZ.
Thank you, Kaz. Welcome, I think we got an ownership change in sports. I think I was like talking about that mostly because I just always hope that like the next owner that comes in is going to be less of a shitbag and things are going to get slightly better. So we've got the Mets bringing in Steve Cohen to be their new owner, or at least I think they've at least zeroed in on Steve Cohen.
I think he's bringing in a group, but he's like kind of
I don't think he needs it.
I gotta find the article I was reading about this whole thing, but yeah, so Steve Cohen, pretty well-known businessman, hedge fund manager, is gonna be
that's a pretty well-known shitbag. I don't know, maybe it's better to have a rich shitbag than a poor shitbag that's gonna try to milk as much money from the team as possible.
Yeah, it depends, right? Because we end up in a lot of the situation, right? Like in comparison, right, we have the Washington DC football team, who is owned by a pretty well-known shitbag, and it's been that way forever, and it has taken almost the downfall of America to get him to change the racist name of his team. And then we have a shitbag in the owner of the Knicks, who I don't really even understand his shitbaggery. Like, you would think you would want the Knicks to be a good team, but for some reason they don't. and they're not going for draft picks. There's no real understanding there. It's just a person who just is like milking this team for some weird reason.
Yeah. Well, in his case, it's not even for lack of investment either. He's been perfectly willing to pay out when he needs to. It's just he's just been bad at it. Making the wrong hires and going for maybe a little bit too much flash over actual substance and building from the ground up. I think we like to laugh at the Mets a lot.
Yeah, because I mean,
some weird things every so often, and then there's the Bobby Bonilla thing every year, but
they're the second team in New York, right? And some people are going to come at me sideways, but because I'm a Yankees fan and I'm saying this, but you know, you have the New York Yankees, you have this kind of illustrious franchise, and then you have the Mets that, you know, they've kind of paled in comparison. They've had their ups and downs, but they've had more downs than they have had ups.
Yeah, and it's tough being the second team in a city. I think, right now everybody's laughing at the Clippers.
And as they should be, they blew it.
Yeah, as they should be, but it's, but I think, if you were to compare it to other sports, you know, you've got Rangers, Islanders, you've got Nets, Knicks, and in this case, it's kind of the Nets are the flashy team in town right now.
They also came under kind of new banner, changed their name. Well, not changed their name, but changed their location, kind of changed their team identity, and now have become a destination where. Because of the downfall of the Knicks, they are no longer a destination, right? Nobody wants to go to the Knicks. The Brooklyn, this new shiny thing, seems like the team that you want to go to.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, like every time a billionaire comes in and takes over that second team, there's always the question of maybe they're going to invest a bunch of money into the team so that they can kind of get out of the shadow of the other team. I know Steve Ballmer has definitely tried to do that with the Clippers. They are, technically the third team in their arena because the Lakers get first dibs on scheduling, and then the LA Kings get second options on scheduling, and they also play in the Staples Center, and then the Clippers get the third option. So they're at least trying to move out of the building and build another building somewhere so that, so that they're basically not playing in the Lakers' house and getting shafted with the poor scheduling. But yeah, it's
and blowing 3-1 leads doesn't help that though.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's kind of you're kind of little brother syndrome until you can establish a good solid record of success, sustained success, not just like a flash in the pan every few years, because the Angels do that in Anaheim. But you know, they have a bit of a mixed history. They haven't made the playoffs in a while, and you know, on top of that, they had to change their name to the Los Angeles Angels just to try to help maintain a little bit of relevance in their region. Although that's probably not the best example of a little brother team. They're still pretty successful, and I know quite a few Angels fans that are very enthusiastic. But I just can't help taking shots at them because they're wasting like Trout's career. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with the Mets. We'll have to wait and see whether this deal even goes through. But Steve Cohen.
Mets on the clock.
Mets on the clock. A bit of a local story for one of us. The Detroit Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire has retired midseason to focus on his health. DGM, do you have any insider information on that or local information?
Yeah. What's up, everybody? Ron Gardenhire was the Detroit Tigers manager for the last 3 years. And he announced that he was retiring from baseball yesterday, as we're recording this, citing health concerns. A couple of weeks ago, during all of this, Ron Gardenhire took a few days off because of a stomach flu, non-COVID related. But when he came back, he still wasn't feeling too great. He cited that he felt shaky, he didn't have quite as much energy, and of course the stress of being the manager of a major league ball club, it all kind of caught up with him, and he announced on Saturday that he would be retiring from baseball. A long, long career in the big leagues, also being the manager of the Minnesota Twins for many, many years. And Lloyd McClendon, the bench coach, and was also the manager of the Toledo Mudhens, their AAA affiliate for a while, will be taking over managerial duties for the remainder of the season. So it's sounding like Ron Gardenhire, who was in his 60s and has actually had, I believe, a few health scares in the past, finally felt like, okay, this might be it for me. He pointed out that he's got grandkids and he wants to be home and take care of his wife and all of that. So it sounds like it was a health decision, maybe an age decision, and maybe just overall managing a major league team kind of took it out of him a little bit. But he was a great personality, doing a really good job of managing the Tigers' rebuild. They were 21-29 so far during this season. Younger players were looking better, improving. Tiger development was seemingly going on a good path. And I think by a lot of people in baseball, he was one of the good guys in the room. So he'll be sorely missed by a lot of people in baseball.
All right. Yeah. I think I said middle of the season. I think because it still feels like the middle of the season, but we are basically nearing the end of the season at this point. We've basically got a week or two of games left, I think. Just the 60 game season is catching me off guard. There's only just the end of the season left. It doesn't really look like the Tigers are in the playoff race. Pretty much a good time to make this decision and step aside. Although when it comes to health, you kind of just do it, whether it's a good
I'm gonna
time
say
or
something
not.
Really controversial, boys. Right. I want AJ Hinch to manage the Tigers.
I feel like that's, I mean, at some point he's served his punishment.
I want him. I want him.
I think it's okay to want him. I think it's okay to want Alex Cora or Carlos Beltran and all those other people that basically lost their jobs over this whole scandal, because they're not the ones who got away with it. Also, they're not the ones you can throw balls at. So it's, and I think that's okay. I don't think that's too controversial.
Also, on top of that, AJ Hinch had a team of very young players and very high draft picks, and he developed them into a pretty good baseball team, regardless of what the methods were and how you feel about them. He did do that once, so yep. I want that to happen again. I want Justin Verlander to come back from his Tommy John surgery and then come back to the Tigers at the age of 40, and we can all ride off into the sunset together.
Well, I watched a really short ESPN, I forgot what, it's part of their like sub 30 for 30 series, but just their short ones. So I forgot what that series is called, but it was a documentary on the guy who, on Tommy John himself and the guy who invented the surgery, who Tommy John says it should be named after that guy instead. And I should have remembered his name. Because the documentary was telling us to remember his name, but just about like how important the Tommy John surgery has been to so many careers of Major League Baseball players, where that particular injury used to be such a not a death sentence, but like a career ending thing. And now it's one that has, it seems like so many pitchers, you know, maybe the majority of pitchers go through that kind of surgery and come out from it just
Frank Job,
that's his name, yeah. And you know, people come out of Frank Job surgery pitching just as well after maybe like a year of recovery or so, but you know, once they get back in the groove, they're, you know, it's almost like they never left the game. So here's hoping that the same thing happens to Justin Verlander. And here's hoping that he does that with the Tigers. Yeah, because I think he was headed to a headed into a contract year.
I believe next year is his contract year.
Yeah.
And given the recovery time with Tommy John surgery, it will likely run him through that contract. And from there, we'll see what happens. Maybe if the heart of the cards are with the Tigers, they'll be ready to start spending again and coming out of this rebuild, and we'll see how it goes.
All right. Potential shakeups in the AL Central. All right. We haven't talked about hockey for a while, and I think we're kind of let it drift to the point where we're in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah, and, baby.
And the Dallas Stars are leading the Tampa Bay Lightning 1-0 right now. So check that out on your television.
I didn't pick either of these teams to go this far because I didn't know enough about hockey.
Yeah. Well, I think Tampa Bay has kind of been a perennial contender the last couple of years. So I would expect this 1-0 lead is not going to hold, and we'll get a pretty exciting series, which has been a pretty, you know, considering. You know, we've talked a lot about the success of the NBA bubble, but the NHL bubble has also very quietly handled their business with incredible success from a health perspective as well. So all the kudos to them. They're kind of just in the perpetual shadow of the NBA, playing at the same time in the same arenas. And so they need some love, too. Speaking of not handling COVID so well, we got the NFL. I think something that surprised a lot of people last week during the opening games, the very first game of the season, the kickoff between the Chiefs and the Texans. I think people were surprised to see fans in the stands for that game in Kansas City. Yeah, the city of Kansas City, Missouri, and the Chiefs allowed a limited crowd to attend the game. And and then one of those fans tested positive. The Chiefs had actually,
after the game.
Yeah, they tested positive after the game. They Chiefs had actually sent out saliva tests to fans, to like 1,000 fans or so before the game. And then the plan was to not allow people into the stadium if they didn't pass those tests. So right now, everybody's trying to figure out how this guy was able to bypass all of that. At least they were able to catch it right after and identify like all the fans in the area. So 10 other fans are in quarantine right now because of their proximity to this person. But it does sound like everybody who at least interacted with that area was wearing masks. So I think maybe this will just be limited to this one person. We'll have to wait and see on this. I mean, we'll have to wait and see like what the ripple effects are on other plans for other teams, because the Chiefs and the Jags were the only two teams to allow fans into the stadiums for Week 1, but there's more this week. I believe Cleveland allowed some people on Thursday, and then Miami and Indianapolis today, I think, are going to be allowing people. So I think this will just be a bit of a test run, because I think, at least as far as U.S. sports go, at least as far as professional sports go, these are the first teams to actually allow fans. I know college football is kind of just done whatever the hell it wants to. We'll have to wait and see on the effect. As far as college football goes, I'm having trouble keeping track of who's playing and who's not. But it seems like the Big Ten has voted to resume their season on October 24th with the limited 8-game schedule. That's going to end in December. The Mid-American Conference is also in discussion, and I think the Pac-12 is going to also vote later this week whether to resume. Meanwhile, I think the other three conferences in the Power Five, the SEC, the ACC, and the Big Ten, I guess, and the Big 12, have been just playing games with stadiums that actually look kind of full. I don't want to say the success, but maybe the relative non-clusterfuck of what's happened so far with those teams that have played have kind of given encouragement to the conferences that have been sitting out to see whether whether things are going well or not. I don't know if I'd classify myself as cautiously optimistic or classify myself as just waiting for the next shoe to drop. They have testing plans, but I'm just not, when you see how the Chiefs had this testing plan set up for their game and then somebody was able to bypass all that. There's a lot of systems that have to work in order to keep everybody safe here.
Yeah.
And a lot of moving parts. So I'm just a little bit discouraged from that.
It's a risk, right? Like going to a game, you kind of understand that, even with the greatest amount of safety protocols, you're putting yourself at risk. Like even for me right now, right? Like I work in retail, and just every day it's like, cool, I'm at some level of risk, because it just is what it is. It's just the kind of the nature of the beast. Like, and I don't know, man, I don't think I would have wanted to be one of those. I don't think I could have done it. I don't think I would have wanted to go to one of those games.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this is that it's kind of showing like a very clear divide between, because all these players are college students, and, mm-hmm. and it's showing like a very clear structural divide, not just like the normal social divide that you kind of see between, the head honchos on campus, that are playing that are playing college sports, and then just the rest of the students. But yeah, it's showing like these very, you know, some positive, some negative, but just very glaring differences. Like the article points out that, like, you know, these college athletes are, you know, they're getting tests every day. Or at least very often. And then like all the other students just don't, like, it's that they're just not
right.
Worth the effort to do that.
And there's always this consistent level of risk. Right. And then it makes you feel like, from a multitude of standpoints, right? So for the college athlete standpoint, now they have to play risk management, right? So now you can't go anywhere where the normal student body gathers, right? So you have to, like, dirge a certain classes you probably can't go to, right? Because it puts you at risk. You can't go to any kind of anything because it constantly puts you at risk. And then for the other students, you have to have your own risk assessment, just for your own health mentality that the school just doesn't care to provide to you, right? Because they're open for the fact of at this place, as many people have seen, just for making money.
Yeah, and I mean, at this point, there's a lot of students that just aren't even on campus, period, that, you know, they're having to do remote learning. And then on top of that, we've got, you know, like, not only do they have to do it remotely, but, you know, it's the opposite case for the college athletes. They have to be on campus. So it's, you know, and they have to be on campus for the sole purpose of for the sole purpose of basically making money for their schools and maintaining these previously agreed upon financial deals for, you know, the big college sports, at least the big money making sports. So I think it's the other weird thing is it's kind of showing, like, very clearly which sports are quote unquote important and which are not, because we're also seeing some universities just straight up drop some sports, whereas they are going out of their way to make sure that they play college football and college basketball, because those are the money making sports, and those are the ones where they stand to lose millions of dollars if they don't play. So I think it's kind of taking the dirty business of college football, and I think everybody was kind of doing a pretty good job of hiding how dirty it was before. But now that, now that push comes to shove, we're seeing like how far everybody's going to bend over backwards to maintain this current system the way it is. Either way, I'm a little scared for these athletes. Sometimes I know not a lot of businesses are doing this at this point, but, you know, you could say if you're an essential worker, you get hazard pay, but it's not like these kids get hazard scholarships, you know, in order to go out and make all this money for all these rich people that run college sports. And on top of that, they're risking injury. It's a different season. It's, you know, it just feels dirty. It just makes me, I wasn't much of a college sports guy before, and now I feel like even less of it. I just feel dirtier watching it.
Yeah. No, I don't know. It's a weird place to be with college sports and being kind of a sports fan.
I forgot to mention NCAA basketball is actually coming back on November 25th, which I think is only 2 weeks later than it usually starts. So you'd think with all this, it's just not much of a delay. Everybody had talked about, like, maybe postponing everything until the spring. And then it just seems like we're in a worse situation from a COVID perspective than we were in March when everything got canceled, but I mean, I think we're in a better situation from an information perspective and understanding how the virus spreads, but from an infection and statistical perspective, I think we're in a worse situation. So I just, it just seems like everybody, like I said last week, everybody kind of just got over it. And so we're just kind of going back to playing sports because we need to, even though the only reason we really need to is to line the pockets of certain people. So,
yeah. Well, let's just talk about the NBA. College is just gross. So the Clippers blew a 3-1 lead.
Yes.
There's just no way around that.
Kaz?
Yeah.
Hot take time, both of
you. Okay.
We're going to play the sports radio blame game. Okay. Who was it? Kawhi Leonard or Paul George? JVZ?
Oh, Paul George.
Yes?
Oh, man. I don't think I'm allowed to blame Paul George for anything. I like Paul George. Shit. Paul George.
I mean, Kawhi Leonard didn't hit the side of a backboard.
Okay, here's the thing. All right, right. That team, Kawhi Leonard is one of the best all-around players on that team, right? That's just his role. That's what he does. He shoots, he defends, he's great. Paul George is a lockdown defender. He has not been the greatest shooter in his career, right? That is why...
He's okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not...
They're both very good two-way players, and I feel like that was the thing we were talking about when they both signed with the Clippers. They just got two of the best two-way players.
Yeah.
In the game. And honestly, the term two-way players is kind of dumb because every player plays two ways.
And they don't.
You should be a two-way player if you play in the NBA. That's just called being a player. And that's just called doing your job. Yeah, both of them are very good at both aspects of the job. And then at least on the offensive side, I feel like Paul George laid a complete egg. He's had a couple good games this playoff, but I think he's
also
more bad games than good games. And,
you know, I hate to say it because I like Paul George. I've told you, I love Paul George because he is just a no-nonsense defensive player. I think it was one of the playoff series where he was still on the Pacers, maybe, and LeBron was on Cleveland still, and he just did whatever he could to defend LeBron James, and I loved that. But that being said, I think in the last few years, even before he got to this Clippers team, even before all that stuff, there has just kind of been a regression in his play. He's just kind of taken a backseat to a lot of people, where I think before that, he was being looked at as kind of a name in the NBA.
A potential MVP candidate.
Yeah.
And I think even after his like really horrific leg injury, I think one of those years in OKC, he had a tremendous year, and I think basically was not a very good playoff series for him.
Yeah.
I think he had a pretty good season, but it because I don't want to blame it all on him, but you know, DJ put me on the spot, but because I do feel like all the Clippers players, even Kawhi Leonard to an extent, I feel like everybody played at like 80% of what they were capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And then some maybe a little worse than that.
And I kind of want to go look at the numbers, and I meant to do it before this and before I got into laughing at the Clippers for blowing a 3-1 lead. But I just feel like season over season, Paul George's numbers have dwindled. And like you said, he did have a pretty big leg injury. But like you said, after that, he was still playing at the level of Paul George being Paul George. Like he was a main name.
People were saying he's back And I think that people were also saying that he was carrying that OKC team, even though that was technically Russell Westbrook's team.
Mm-hmm.
Because Carmelo Anthony certainly wasn't helping. So it's, I think, we certainly thought of it as a big loss for the Thunder when they had to trade him away. But I think the Oklahoma City Thunder are the winners of all this. Even though they were eliminated last round, we saw the Houston Rockets eliminated in very unceremonious fashion, and we see the LA Clippers eliminated in very in the same round. And it almost seems like both those teams have peaked, and then who owns like all of their future draft picks for those two teams? The Oklahoma City Thunder, who had to trade their stars to those teams, but still ended up okay after that, and are positioned incredibly well for a rebuild, and positioned incredibly well to pounce on the very poor fortunes of the teams who took their superstars away. So,
But I mean, they also. Especially for me and one person, they gave away a very problematic player that they were having a lot of issues with, and they let go a guy who maybe in their eyes, maybe they had the foresight, was dwindling, right? Was just not doing what he used to do. So it is what it is, and you poise yourself for a very quick rebuild in that. But less about the teams that are out and more about the teams that are in.
I feel like we should be talking about the Nuggets more, because it wasn't just a collapse from the Clippers. It was a pretty strong comeback from the Nuggets. And I think we haven't mentioned Jamal Murray enough on this podcast, nor have we mentioned Nikola Jokic enough. Both of those guys are... I mean, they're carrying that team, but I mean, Jamal Murray, I think he's in like his fourth or fifth year. I think when the Nuggets gave him a max contract, I was one of those people that thought, you know, maybe that's one of those times where you give somebody a max contract because just so that nobody outbids you. You want to keep him, but he's probably not actually worth a max contract. But you just do it because, A, you appreciate him, and B, you don't want anybody to outbid you.
And I'm just saying, they got Bol Bol.
Yeah.
That's always on the clock.
For their future, I feel like that's set as well between him and Michael Porter Jr. And like, I feel like they've drafted incredibly well, but on top of that, they've built an incredible team. And then they're well coached by Michael Malone, who was fired by the Sacramento Kings. I am trying to breathe. It's you know, like, you can very clearly see that, like, those players will run through a wall for Michael Malone, which is pretty much what I heard about the players and the Kings at the time that that he was fired from here. So, but on top of that, you know, they're executing plays well. Jamal Murray is hitting clutch shot after clutch shot. I think his 3-point rate is his 3-point efficiency is pretty incredible. And Jokic might be the best center in the NBA. At the very least, he's the best passing center in the NBA. And then when you surround him with
he's a guy who's just kind of worked over his career to become a better player.
Yeah. And you know, as a guy that I believe he was drafted in the second round,
second round, 41st pick of the 2014 draft.
Yeah. And, I don't want to make the Marcus Gasol comparison just because I feel like I'm making a racial comparison there, with two white dudes, but I feel like that's a pretty good comparison as far as career trajectory goes and skill set and passing ability. Jokic, I think, he's also, you know, not necessarily an athletic center. Oh, I mean, all these guys are athletic, but I think he gets criticism for his weight sometimes. But I think he came into the bubble like a lot thinner than everybody expected. So, I mean, they've played two 7-game series you know, having to come back from 3-1 in both of those series. And you know, he, both Jokic and Murray are out there looking fresh. I mean, they look tired after the game, but you know, when it comes time to start the next games, it seems like they're okay. And, so I think, this is a Nuggets team that you cannot count out in any situation at this point. On top of that, for this 3-1 comeback against the Clippers, I believe the Clippers had massive, not necessarily massive, but like 15 plus point leads in all of the last four games. And the Nuggets came back in every single one of them. I think in the final game, they came back and took a pretty big lead as well. So, I think, I don't know how they managed to do this. And I think part of it is the Clippers collapsing as well. But, you know, this is a team that just does not quit. And I'm throwing out so many cliches here, but I feel like the Nuggets have earned all of the good cliches.
Mm-hmm.
Except
now they go up against the Lakers, and Jamal Murray has said they've already run into the problem of them being the younger team going up against a team that has more veterans and has the ear of the refs a little bit more. And this is a thing we've heard a lot, especially going up against LeBron led teams, or, you know, in the NFL going up against Brady led teams, is sometimes the calls fall their way. And in that first game, they're, definitely seemed to be a bit of that, where there were a lot more calls and a lot more fouls that went the Lakers' way that ended up putting Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic in foul trouble, and giving the Lakers a lot of free shots. So, and he wasn't necessarily complaining about it. He was just like, this is kind of one of those things that happen. You know, we're those calls just aren't going to go for us. You know, those calls just aren't going to go our way. But he said the thing that he would love to see change is the ability for LeBron to just be able to go have a 2-minute conversation with a ref, you know, because that affects the game. Even if you can say that ref's not going to pay attention, the more that happens, the more, you know, those kind of people can do those kind of things, affects the game overall.
Yeah. I didn't actually watch game one, but my Twitter feed was very much complaining about the refs. I don't know if that's because it's a Sacramento centric Twitter feed and we have history with the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals when it comes to reffing. But there's a lot of complaining. So I think, you know, we'll see what happens in game two. This is a little bit of a reversing. It's kind of playing into the Nuggets' hands. If they go down 3-1 again, then everybody's just going to be like, oh, here we go again. But the Lakers have lost their last two game ones. So it's kind of flipping the script a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think, but it also might be the case where the Nuggets are just flat out tired, and
which is one of the things we talked about, right? About the endurance coming out of the West, right? You have to have the endurance to come out of the West. You have to be willing to play series, which is why we thought a team like the Nuggets, well, not the Nuggets, but the Milwaukee Bucks would be able to just kind of walk through the East, because we didn't think anybody was going to be willing to play a series. But I think one of the big things we did not account for, that I've seen other articles kind of account for this NBA playoffs, is no one has to travel.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody has to travel. These are all isolated games, right? There is no home court. There is no away court. Everybody's relatively playing on the same courts. The only difference that this article noted outside of the Jamal Murray thing is the referees, right? Is you are going to see, similar refs throughout these games. But that being said, I forget the article I found, and I'm gonna have to find it again later. But it was kind of just a noting how this might be just the best version of basketball, right?
Because it does feel very, I don't know if pure is the right word, but at least like isolated. It feels like a good experiment, a well-conducted experiment of which team is actually better than another team. And because
you don't it's one have of those... fans. It's one of those things, right? Do the Clippers lose a 3-1 lead if they also have to travel and then they get to play some of those games at home, right? Like, or is it because of the isolation? Because they don't have the crowd? Because, are the refs being more cognizant of the calls because there aren't people booting them?
That's actually, studies have been done on home court and home field advantage, and I think the reffing factor is one of the biggest parts of that. It's not as big a factor as some people would like to claim it is, but it's a slight edge. It's a 4 or 5% edge in favor of one team versus another. I could be getting those numbers wrong, but I believe it's it's a slight edge in favor of the home team when it comes to reffing. So it is really weird to see the high seeds drop the first two games in these different playoff series, because normally you expect, the high seed to be playing those games at home. And, they put up the video board and, let fans of the home team call in on their Zoom and pipe in crowd noise and stuff, but it's not remotely the same.
No.
And I think that's because the refs probably don't give a shit about what's on the video board. It's mm-hmm. They give a shit about fans in person screaming at them, and so it is a different environment. There's also the idea that shooters are getting hot in the bubble. I think 3-point percentage is up. And that's favoring some of the teams that have better shooters. I think the Miami Heat are one of those teams. They've got Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson who are shooting absolutely lights out right now. And, so right now they've got a 2-1 lead over the Celtics, which was 2-0, before yesterday's game.
And all the games have been, except for that third game, all these games have been close, right? So game one was 117-114 for the Heat.
Yeah, which ended on one of the most amazing defensive plays, maybe outside of the LeBron chase down block in the finals. I think that might have been the greatest block I've ever seen, with Bam Adebayo denying Jason Tatum at the rim. Near the end of the game on what would have been a game tying possession. These have been dramatic games with a lot of highlight plays. And even if the TV ratings don't show it, the basketball quality has been incredibly high.
But that being said, so these are the teams we have left, right? So most people are going to put their eggs on the basket of the Lakers beating the Nuggets. But I think I'm going to have to apologize to them, and I'm going to have to pack my stuff and hop on the bandwagon. But the more I look at this Heat team, the more I respect them. And I think I should apologize saying that they were just going to, get walked over by the Bucks, because they have proven me so wrong. Jimmy Butler has been playing I couldn't help but think that this team was nothing but Jimmy Butler, right? And
you couldn't imagine a better fit for him than this team. It's been incredible compared to all the shit that we threw at him last year. Maybe some of it rightfully so, but I think this team's personality and the way it's built, it just it just fits him so well. And he makes his teammates better. They make him better. It's been incredible to watch. And
as much as I like the Celtics team, right? They have Gordon Hayward. I like Gordon Hayward. Gordon Hayward's a great guy. They have Kemba Walker. Kemba Walker is one of the just like seems like the chillest guy to ever come into basketball, because he came in around the same time as like Kyrie and some other like very loud dudes. No, Kyrie's kind of chill too. But Kemba Walker just is like the nicest guy ever. And Jason Tatum is just an all around good basketball player, two way players, as the now goes. But other than that, other than those three, this is kind of a weak team.
I don't know. I feel like it's an underperforming team because Jaylen Brown has been pretty incredible up until this series.
Yeah.
Marcus Smart.
Ernest Kanter is a really good regular season player. I just don't think he does the things he does in the regular season in the playoffs.
Part of me thinks the 2-0 start to this Heat Celtics series was the Heat catching the Celtics off guard, because I feel like we're seeing a Celtics adjustment right now. And I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if this series goes seven games, because on top of all the excellent players that are involved in this series, we've got two excellent coaches here. And I don't think Eric Spoelstra gets enough credit for being a fantastic coach. And I feel like since LeBron left the team, everybody's come around to how good of a coach he actually is. And I still think he is the best coach that LeBron has ever had. And I think he might be the best coach left in the playoffs right now. So I think, with all that, I wouldn't count the Heat out of any of this. If DGM is going to make us pick the results of both of these series, I think I'm going to have to jump on the bandwagon and root for a Heat Nuggets NBA Finals. Mm-hmm. Just because that would be a nice change, and just because I just always pick against the Lakers. I feel like if there is, and I would just hate to see Celtics Lakers in the finals again. this would be like, I don't know, maybe the 10th time in my lifetime that's happened.
Yeah. The thing is, I think Lakers Celtics is boring. I think the Celtics could take a couple of games from the Lakers, but I think down the run, I don't think the Celtics have the staff to defend the Lakers. But I do think the Heat do. If it comes down to Heat Lakers, they have, you know, Udonis Haslem, Jay Crowder, Andre Iguodala,
and Adebayo has been an incredible defensive player as well.
Yeah. And I think any of those guys could very easily defend LeBron.
Okay. Don't say easily when it comes to defending LeBron, but
yeah. Well, I mean, if you decide to play good health defense and the people don't just fall off of Anthony Davis like they do to double team LeBron. You gotta have the right guys move over at the right times.
That's
an easier thing on paper than it is to actually do.
If the Lakers do make the finals, this is setting the stage for J.R. Smith Finals MVP. For your sake, to not have to buy a Knicks jersey, I think we have to root against that at least. But hey, all this playoff talk is just reminding me personally that the Kings aren't in it and haven't been in it for the last 14 seasons.
And you guys have a pretty good team right now. Like I think you have one of the best point guards to come out of one of the most recent drafts.
The best point guard to come out of the Jason Tatum draft so far. That's assuming Markel Fultz doesn't eventually get it together and reach his potential.
Which is possible.
Yeah, it's possible. But I spent, I think, an hour a couple podcasts ago ranting about their GM situation, and so it looks like they've completed the process. They've hired a general manager, and the guy they got is Monty McNair, who is an assistant general manager under basically Daryl Morey's lead assistant for the Rockets. So I think this is what's encouraging about this is, they hired a search firm to come in and whittle down like a short list of candidates, which already is a good sign, because last time they kind of just picked a guy that they were comfortable with. Vivek Ranadive basically just hired his friend Vlade Divac to come in and run the team. This time they actually like looked at candidates from around the league who were like the top assistants that could potentially move up to the next level and run their own teams. And I think they narrowed it down to like six different people. Some of them, about half of them, turned down the Kings and basically just said, yeah, we're not interested, which is fine. But in this case, they were able to interview a couple of those people and select Monty McNair. So at least the process seems to work out. Mm-hmm. It seems to be thorough this time.
I'm happy with that. Coming into this, right? So now you have a new GM. You're coming into a new year. You have De'Aaron Fox, right?
And he's the only person on this team that is untradeable at this point.
Okay, hold on. All right. Know what? Let's do it. We're doing the Kings rebuild right here, right now. I'm looking at this team, right? You got, let's kind of look at that, the non-negotiables, right? De'Aaron Fox is definitely a non-negotiable. You keep him, you build particularly around him, right?
Yeah.
I would make a case as well for Jabari Parker as being a pretty good non-negotiable. He's a good defensive player. His offense could use work. I don't think is enough of a word, but it could use some work. Buddy Hield, he could definitely be used as trade bait or be used as a person to come off the bench. He has a pretty good shot, and he's not scared to drive the lane against most opponents. So depending on what you could get for him in a straight up trade, I'd either work around Buddy Hield or I would give him up for something, because he was a pretty high draft pick. So that's money coming off the table if you keep him. Melvin Bagley, yeah, no, he's gone. Bogdan Bogdanovic, he's gone. Harrison Barnes, I don't know why he's still here in the first place. And then everyone else is trade bait or bench bait for other people.
All right. Local perspective. Jabari Parker is trash. he's been okay on offense. He's not very good on defense. The Kings traded for him and he didn't even play until the bubble, basically.
Yeah.
And then he was a turnstile on defense. We got one more year of him and then his contract is gone. So like maybe he can be traded, maybe not. But I think they traded for him to in order to just as like a desperation thing, but also in order to get rid of Dwayne Dedmon, who was a very bad offseason signing. The Buddy Hield is one of the best shooters in the NBA. But his value is at its lowest right now, so probably not necessarily a good time to trade him.
Yeah, that's why I said in my version of the keep the keeper give, Buddy Hield could be a good off the bench player. You know, he could be a great sixth man.
That's what he's doing right now, but he's also very unhappy doing that, and he's being paid like a starter. So, and his contract kicks in next year. It is declining. Declining scale contract, so he'll get cheaper every year as it goes on. But I think to maximize Buddy Hield, the best thing you could do is fire Luke Walton at this point.
Oh, yeah.
So there's that specter hanging over the team of what's going to happen with the coach. But yeah, that's why I think it's so important for them to get a general manager hire done early, so that somebody can actually make these decisions, especially leading up to the draft, especially if somebody offers a trade for Buddy Hield. So it's a bit of a fluid situation here. Bogdan Bogdanovic is a restricted free agent, I believe. So I think the Kings can match whatever contract somebody else chooses to offer him. But that's a lot of money to pay two people, both him and Buddy Hield, to play the same position, and aren't going to be able to play. Like, one of them's going to have to come off the bench. So they can socially coexist together. They're very good friends, but Buddy Hield is very unhappy right now. So the thought is maybe get rid of him, but right now his trade value is at its lowest. So maybe not a good time. Maybe you want to see what he does when a better coach is coaching this team. Because when he's on his game, he is, you know, a Steph Curry level shooter.
Yeah.
Curry level at off the ball movement and all the other great things that Steph Curry does. But as far as shooting goes, he's shooting at roughly the same percentages.
And I think that's something to always kind of keep as a mindset in these keep take scenarios, right? Is you have to kind of keep in mindset of coachability, right?
Yeah. Coachability, potential, and where their value is at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because you also mentioned Marvin Bagley, and he's been disappointing, but also he's been injured this whole time. So, and also he's still on his rookie contract, so he's not costing the team that much. He's just disappointing every time you look at him, because every time you look at him, you see Luka Doncic, and that's not fair to him. So it's
deep breaths, JVZ, deep breaths. Oh, it's going to be okay.
I'm just saying, next week we're doing a Pistons rebuild, because we're going to fucking blow that.
I'm down with the Pistons rebuild. I'm down for it.
But basically, you cannot trade Marvin Bagley now. His value is at the lowest it will ever be. So just ride out the next 2 years and see what happens.
Do you want to do the Knicks rebuild the week after, Cass?
Fuck yeah, bud.
All right. Let's put that in.
So this is what I think, especially for the Kings, right? And the way the Kings have been good at basketball in their history and maybe into their future with what I, now that I've been watching basketball again, what I think is you guys, I think you have one of the best point guards right now, right? The kid does it all.
Except shoot,
right? But he can. Yeah, right. It's not a Ben Simmons situation, but
right. It's a Russell Westbrook situation, though.
Yeah, he'd much rather jump over somebody than just take the easy fucking stop and take a 13-footer, which I kind of do. Like, I've been watching some of De'Aaron Fox, and I kind of wish he would just stop and take the 13-foot jump shot. Like, they give it to him, and then he just keeps running at people.
And then he just collides. And then, he's been getting stronger, so I'm less worried about him getting injured, but he does get injured quite a bit. So it worries me. But there's pieces to work with on this team. And now that we have competent leadership, I think cautiously optimistic over the next 3 years. But I know it's going to take, I'm patient enough because I have no choice, But over the next 3 years, I feel like this team is going to make either slow strides or they might blow some things up here and there and accumulate some pieces. But they have some stuff to work with. It's not as bare as the Philadelphia 76ers were when they started their process. The Kings don't have to blow everything up, but they are probably going to set the record for most consecutive years missing the playoffs. So that's not going to be fun when that happens, but at the very least, hopefully I can feel like this team is headed in a positive direction. And at this point, that's all I need or all I can really reasonably ask for.
Yeah.
All right.
I think so too. All right.
Well, just one quick note. Giannis Antetokounmpo is the 2020 NBA MVP. He is also Defensive Player of the Year. Congratulations to him for that.
Oh, I have so much I want to talk about, but we're running close on time, so I'm not going to get into it.
But we shouldn't. I don't like whining about NBA awards voting just because it's I think so many of the voting problems there and in America in general are centered around our inability to do just a normal nomination vote and then a runoff vote. Like, yeah. I feel like that's a very simple thing. And yet we find ways to complicate that shit. And then you get people complaining about like, oh, this reporter didn't vote for these people. And this reporter voted for this obscure person. And who the fuck cares? Like, if you just give people like three people to pick from, then you don't have to worry about those fringe choices getting accumulated. But I digress. On the WNBA side, Asia Wilson is the 2020 WNBA MVP in just her third season. So I think that's a tremendous accomplishment for her, leading the Las Vegas Aces to the number one seed. She averaged 20 and a half points, 8.5 rebounds, 2 assists and 2 blocks in just her in her third season. And just keep in mind when I read those numbers that those are for 40-minute games. So it's definitely carrying her team, especially since they were missing Liz Cambage this year. Tremendous performance from her. Breonna Stewart, who returned after missing all of last season, is got the runner up when it comes to first place votes. And Courtney Vandersloot, who we didn't talk about all year, but she set she was just on a tremendous assist pace, and I think set the record for at least the highest assist average per game at I think 10 assists and again per 40 minutes. So I think a lot of standouts this year in the WNBA season. Meanwhile, we've reached the WNBA semifinals. Las Vegas and Connecticut are one matchup. Connecticut Sun kind of surprised everybody. They coming from the eighth seed. They do kind of a weird single elimination system for the first two rounds and for just the bottom four seeds. And then Connecticut managed to win both of those games, both of their matchups. And then so now they face Las Vegas in a 5-game series. Dewana Bonner is making a name for herself carrying that team. Minnesota versus Seattle is the other series, and I believe game one of that has been postponed due to an inconclusive COVID test. So but check out the WNBA playoffs. It's gonna get gritty, I think. When you get to playoff WNBA basketball, these women go hard. Let's go to, I guess, one of the topics that is always near and dear to my heart, and that is Frank Gore, 49ers legend, just NFL legend in general. Somebody who's always kind of at the center of, is this guy going to make the Hall of Fame or not? Just because he's always been kind of solid to good, but never necessarily leading the league. But, you know, he's now set the record for the most games played by a running back in NFL history. Last week, he played in his 227th game, passing Emmitt Smith, who has 226. Emmitt Smith being the NFL's all-time leading rusher when it comes to yardage. Frank Gore is, I believe, third on that list. He's about 1,000 yards behind Walter Payton, and I believe Emmitt Smith is—I don't want to say a handful, but like less or somewhere around 100 yards ahead of that. I don't know the actual numbers, but Frank Gore has played for 16 seasons, which is an incredibly long career for one of the most punishing positions in the league, and I think only Marcus Allen has played for that many seasons. So I think in terms of longevity itself, I feel like Frank Gore is, you know, you almost have to put him in the Hall of Fame just for that. Just to put it in perspective, how long Frank Gore has played in the NFL, his son, it just made his debut for Southern Miss, in college football. So if Frank Gore manages to play for 3 or 4 more years, we might actually get to see a father-son tandem play in the NFL together, which, considering how punishing the NFL is physically, I think is a pretty remarkable achievement. I don't know if anybody else has ever, any other family has ever achieved that. I know
LeBron is trying.
Well, yeah, for basketball, which is a little bit less punishing. And I'm pretty sure he's going to be able to achieve that, because I think LeBron's got, at least another 4 years left. And he spends so much money taking care of his body every year. And he's got Anthony Davis to kind of shoulder some of that load. But I know for baseball, there's, you know, very famously, Barry and Bobby Bonds. And then also Ken Griffey Jr. and Sr. Who I think if you want to look up a really cool moment on YouTube, there's a clip of them hitting back to back home runs in a game. So I don't think we'll ever see anything like that in football. It'll be kind of lucky if Frank Gore Sr. and Jr. ever make it onto the same NFL team. But I don't know, Frank Gore.
Trying to see like what else. I mean, there obviously there's a lot in stock car.
Oh, the Ripkins. Chimera mentioned the Ripkins. The chat. The Ripkins. No, scratch that. DGM is predicting that Lamar Jackson is throwing to his own son in 2036.
Get out of here.
I mean, I think this might be something that we see happen more often, at least in the NBA or in baseball, just because we're getting better at taking care of bodies. I think the problem is, as we get better at taking care of bodies and maintaining athleticism in the NFL, that means the hits get harder, the punishment gets tougher. So like we've seen careers kind of shorten in the NFL, whereas we've seen careers extended in all the other sports. I mean, we've got baseball players that are signing contracts with the expectation that they're going to play till they're 40 or so. Whereas we've only got, you know, two people or so in the NFL that are at least 40 years old. So I think just for the running back position in general, I mean, you hear me talk about it more than anybody else, about how, you know, don't pay running backs. They've got, you know, 3 or 4 good years and then they're done. And Frank Gore has managed to prove me wrong on that front at, you know, four times that career length. Going into his 16th season, I fully expect him to make it another 4 years, and he's still going to be averaging 3.5 yards a carry. And he's starting today's game, which is, you know, pretty incredible. Like Le'Veon Bell is the running back ahead of him, but he's injured. Whereas Frank Gore is still chugging along.
Yeah.
so it's, you know, I think he's a one of a kind. And I don't think he'll ever be a Hall of Famer, because you have to retire to make the Hall of Fame. And I don't think Frank Gore is ever going to retire. People have probably heard me make that joke over and over again. So before I repeat any more jokes, just want to thank everybody for listening to this show, sportsoddsandends.com, for links to all the show notes, links to all of our stories. Head on over there to get links to iTunes, Google Podcasts, and all the other podcatcher places. There's also a link to our Patreon there, patreon.com/sportsoddsandends. I will also add a link to our Twitch channel, which currently is twitch.tv/JVZ. We are starting to stream these live and then probably work in some Sunday NFL hangouts along with it as well. So so check out that if you want to listen to this show live. We normally try to record Sundays at around 2 p.m. Eastern. On top of that, if you want to hit us up on Twitter throughout the week, I'm at JVZ on Twitter. Kaz is at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.